Here's the top stories. China slams what it calls the U.S. wanton oppression of its companies after Washington extended a blacklist of alleged Chinese military firms. Iranian health minister says U.S. unilateral sanctions have adversely affected the fight against the coronavirus pandemic in Iran. Also ahead, three UN agencies warned that Yemen is on the brink of famine, saying the number of Yemenis experiencing food insecurity could nearly triple next year. Welcome. China has slammed the U.S. for extending a blacklist of companies Washington says are controlled by the Chinese military. Beijing says it's firmly opposed to what it calls Washington's wanton oppression of Chinese companies. It urged the U.S. to stop abusing the concept of national security. China said the measure will severely harm the U.S. interest and image. The companies added on Thursday to the U.S. blacklist include China's top chipmaker and oil giant. More companies have already been put on the list under an executive order signed by U.S. President Donald Trump last month. The U.S. accuses China of using all those firms to modernize its military. China denies that. The Iranian health minister says U.S. unilateral sanctions against his country have adversely affected the fight against the pandemic in Iran.
The unilateral coercive measures imposed by the government of the United States have negatively affected the process of combating the pandemic in my country. Unilateral illegal measures hampers easy access of the people to basic medical items and requirements and thus endangers health of Iranian citizens.
Said Namaki made the remark in an address to the UN General Assembly. He said it is important that all nations have timely and cost-effective access to medicines and medical supplies without any discrimination. But he added U.S. restrictions on forex reserves are hampering efforts to supply medicines and medical equipment. Washington has imposed what the U.S. officials call unprecedented sanctions against Tehran since it withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018. Iran calls the sanctions economic terrorism and says they are targeting ordinary people. The U.S. has imposed fresh Iran-related sanctions as part of its so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. The U.S. Treasury Department said the sanctions target a research group and its director linked to Iran's defense ministry. The department accuses the entity of being involved in Iran's chemical weapons research. The Treasury Department said the U.S. will continue to counter what it called Iran's efforts to advance its malign agenda. Iran has time and again rejected such allegation and says the U.S. is the source of instability in West Asia. Iran also wants a ban on chemical weapons. The U.S. itself is one of the biggest owners of such weapons. During World War II, the U.S. bombed Japan and with nuclear bombs, killing over 100,000 people. Bangladesh has sent another batch of Rohingya refugees to a remote island despite a call by rights groups to halt the transfer. A Bangladeshi naval official says more than 1,600 refugees have been sailed to Bahashan Char Islands. They will join another 400 being moved on Thursday. Dhaka says it is only moving Rohingya refugees who are willing to go. It also says the transfer will ease overcrowding in camps home to more than 1 million Rohingya. But rights groups, including prominent Amnesty International, want to halt to the relocation. They say it may be forced and involuntary. Hundreds of thousands of Myanmar's Rohingya Muslims fled to Bangladesh in August of 2017 after a brutal crackdown by their government.
Rohingya Muslims, a long maltreated group who is denied citizenship at home in Myanmar. They began fleeing their homes in Rakhine State after waves of attacks by Myanmar's army and Buddhist mobs. A citizenship law in 1982 stripped them of their nationality, making them one of the world's largest stateless communities. While there have been waves of migrations to Bangladesh since the 1970s, none was as rapid and massive as the one in August 2017 that turned the spotlight on the Rohingya crisis around the world. hundreds of thousands of Muslims were violently uprooted in the months that followed, driven by a brutal military crackdown that killed thousands of them. What happened in August 2017 was so horrific that the United Nations calls it genocide and a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Over 700,000 Rohingya fled to Bangladesh. Thousands more sought refuge in India and other neighboring countries. Those who survived tell stories of burning villages, murder, rape, and babies being thrown into fires. Myanmar's military officials claimed that what happened to the villages were a counter-offensive aimed at uprooting terrorism. But the United Nations slammed the army's actions as clearly disproportionate and without regard for basic principles of international law. Today, Bangladesh alone is home to nearly a million Rohingya refugees. At least half of those who arrived in the country were children. These people now live in cramped temporary housing in the district of Cox's Bazar, waiting for a day to return home. The Rohingya want justice. They want those who committed the crimes against them to be held accountable. Myanmar's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, has been accused of failing to protect the minority group. Suu Kyi even rejected a UN report about the military's violence and defended her government's actions in the Rakhine State.
Myanmar requests the court to remove the case from its list. In the alternative, to reject the request for the indication of provisional measures submitted by the Gambia.
There were also talks of Rohingya repatriation, which never happened. Firstly, because Myanmar's government is unwilling to accept the refugees. And secondly, due to Rohingya Muslims fearing for their safety if they returned to their country. A UN fact-finding mission in Myanmar says approximately 600,000 Rohingya are still inside the country, living under the threat of genocide. Given Myanmar's leaders' reluctance to address the issue, the minority group's fate is a major cause for concern that is only being voiced by a selected group of countries around the world.
UN agencies have warned that Yemen is on the brink of famine and the window to prevent a food crisis there is narrowing. The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Food Programme, and the UN Agency for Children have issued a joint statement. They said the number of Yemenis experiencing a catastrophic food insecurity could nearly triple next year to reach 47,000. The UN agency said the alarming number must be a wake-up call for the world to take action. The humanitarian situation has worsened in Yemen since Saudi Arabia waged its war there in March of 2015. The conflict has devastated Yemen's infrastructure and killed tens of thousands of people. Now, European Council President Charles Michel says the bloc wants to reach a post-Brexit trade deal with the UK, but not at any price. Michel said it is essential to ensure that any agreement is acceptable to all EU members. He said the UK has to decide if it wants to sign up to ambitious social, labor, and environment production standards to get a deal. The EU Council chief said if one side of the table rejects a tentative agreement, then it will be a no-deal scenario. He said the next few days will show what comes next. Inside the UK, Business Secretary Alok Sharma says time is short for a chance to reach a deal.
We are committed to reaching agreement with the EU on this particular discussion that we are having. But of course, time is short and we are in a difficult phase. There's no denying that. There are a number of tricky issues that still have to be resolved. But the fundamental point I want to make this really very, very clear to your viewers is that we want the EU to recognise that the UK is a sovereign and independent nation. And it is on the basis of that that a deal will be done.
London and Brussels have been holding trade talks for months without any breakthrough. The thorniest issue are fishing rights, fair competition, and finding ways to settle disputes. Any agreement that may emerge must be approved by the 27 members of the EU as well as the UK Parliament. France has warned that it may use its veto to block a deal if it does not meet Paris's demands. Britain left the EU in January. A transition period is now in place until the end of December. That's also the deadline for reaching a post-Brexit trade deal. Well, time is running out for the European Union and Britain to reach a post-Brexit trade deal, with significant differences remaining between the two sides. We discuss that issue at length with our guests in our news review program.
European diplomats have cast doubt over a post-Brexit trade deal with the UK, citing significant divergences between the two sides. A member of the EU negotiation team said London and Brussels are working hard to try to overcome the gaps, but final outcome of negotiations is still uncertain. A separately European diplomat warned that there will be no more concessions in trade talks with Britain. He said the bloc's negotiators have moved to, quote, within millimeters of the limits of their mandate at the talks. A diplomat stressed that it is now up to London to compromise if a deal is to be reached. And now joining us for the program is Tony Gosling, investigative journalist from Bristol, and Rodney Shakespeare, professor of binary economics, joining us from London. Gentlemen, nice to have you both on. Welcome to the program. I guess we'll start there with you, Professor Shakespeare. Your initial thoughts on where we stand today. We've got about 27 or 28 days left before this transition period is to expire. What do you expect we'll see?
A few weeks ago, Dominic Cummings was ejected from Downing Street. And I think that's probably a sign that the British government is starting to be more accommodating with Europe and probably attempting to make an agreement. My feeling is that there will be an attempt at agreement. It will be a very weak agreement with certain parts of it still to be decided. That does not mean that any agreement will be approved by the other heads of government or by the European Parliament. We must never forget that the Americans will have a say in this, and that any move in the UK to end the Good Friday Agreement between North and South, the two parts of the island, of Ireland, will also be a factor in it. So there you are. I think it's moving towards some sort of agreement, but a very, very weak one. And all the big issues are still lying there underneath. If there is an agreement, the hardline Brexiteers are going to be the ones who are going to be upset, because basically they want to leave the EU and then have no means by which anybody can stop us lowering employment standards, lowering environmental standards, lowering consumer standards. They just simply want to have a sort of free trade, low wage economy. So I think something will happen, but it'll be very weak.
Thank you, Professor. And Tony, welcome to the program. Do you share that optimism that something, possibly a weak deal, may take shape in the next couple of weeks?
Well, look, this is a very important deal, isn't it? Because when Britain joined the EEC, before the whole idea of a political union was sneaked upon the public, and there was never any proper vote about that. There was in some countries, but not here. We were all just told to accept it. Britain was actually a very much more powerful industrial nation. We've seen our industries go, but more importantly, the British had a great deal of fishing rights all around, actually around the North Sea, down the Channel. Actually much more than they've had, obviously, since they've joined the EEC and the European Union. So there's a great deal of discussion going on about these things. I honestly don't think that the EU in Brussels can afford to give Britain any kind of deal, because they know that other European countries are going to be looking at what deal Britain gets, and they'll be expecting to get something similar if they decide to leave. And the whole point here is to dissuade other countries. And in fact, it's the populations in those countries, because the political leaders in other countries, apart from possibly in Hungary and Poland, are already decided that they are wedded to Brussels, because there's a gravy train in Brussels where they know that a senior politician in Germany or France, Spain, anywhere else like that, if they get ousted by their population, their public, then they will find themselves magically spirited into Brussels to become an EU commissioner. So they'll be running the whole show, even though their public has rejected them. That's how perverse I think the EU system works. Or doesn't work, and of course it hasn't been working with the financial crises, the migrant crises. I mean, you know, you can name one after the other loads of problems that the that Brussels and the EU have had. But look, coming down to the line as we're doing at the end of December was always going to be problematic, and the EU, I don't think, is going to give Britain any kind of deal, even the Canada deal that David Davis and other negotiators. Although he's not actually directly negotiating, he's behind the scenes because he's a former Brexit secretary, at least a negotiator for Brexit in the past. They are saying that they're going to get a bad deal, and they want a Canada deal, but they're not going to be even given that. That's the same deal as we've got with Canada. This is the obvious thing to say in order to get the EU to agree to something. The Canada deal is the thing to get. It's obvious. It's already been agreed. And so that's peculiar that the EU don't want to agree to that. The answer, I think, is because we've got an EU that knows that it can't give Britain a deal. So they are kind of almost been wasting their time maybe doing some of these negotiations. I don't think there'll be a deal. And that's the way that Brussels is going to, I think, punish Britain when it comes to the end of December.
Interesting. And you hear France and the Netherlands kind of taking that same hard line and pessimistic approach to this whole thing. Now, Professor Shakespeare, my second question to you, sir. From the time that we saw the referendum on Brexit until current day, how have you seen sentiments, if they've changed at all? To what extent have people throughout the UK, citizens, changed sentiments with respect to how they view Brexit? You know, if they supported it, and they still do, or the ones that don't, have they changed sides or whatnot?
Well, there's no doubt that people wanted to get the thing settled. But of course, this is a massive thing with much detail. And my feeling is that there has been a sort of shift back to some sort of deal, a very tenuous deal, because people recognize is that roughly half our trade goes to and from Europe. And under world trade rules, there'll be some tariffs. And certain industries like cars or, say, agriculture, the tariffs could be much higher.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us. Time has gotten the better of us. I want to thank you both. Do stay safe till we see both of you again. That's Tony Gosling there joining us from Bristol, and Rodney Shakespeare joining us out of London. And that's a wrap for this segment of Your News Review. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
And that's it with international news.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Was not the first Iranian scientist to be assassinated in the past decade.
but he was a pillar of Iran's scientific development and services for military and even medical purposes. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was ambushed in a weekend mountainous resort off Tehran on Friday, the 7th of November. Drag America into an unnecessary war and get it to set the rest of West Asia ablaze too. And why? Just to hold on to your own illegitimate existence. It's not proven, of course, that said scientist was assassinated by Israel. But the evidence is tangible and the motive no secret. But why now? And will it have been worth the effort? For answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. It's probable that Trump will be a single-term president, and if Biden takes office in the coming months, as it is assumed by his campaign slogans, he might return to the Iran nuclear deal and try to make U.S.'s approach different to that of Trump's and pick up talks with Iran. Now, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has said loud and clear there must be no return to the previous nuclear agreement. What better motive for killing off Iran's elites and military scientists, especially with America on your side? Kill him off, provoke Iran, get America to counter-react, and there go any hopes for talks. Mr. Ruivaran is a Middle East analyst, always with historic detail handy to support his comments. Let's hear him out.
The goal behind the assassination of yet another prominent Iranian scientist seems pretty straightforward. But what would you say it is?
In my opinion, there are two goals behind this assassination. It's a general goal that those seeking to restrict Iran's military industry have stepped in to turn their demands into an operational stage and thus assassinate the father of Iran's military industry. This has been a large-scale goal. The name of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh has already been mentioned by the Mossad and the CIA. The second goal was tactical. They seek to force Iran to make a rash reaction to this event. Basically, Mr. Trump is working with Israel to make Iran do something that would make it fundamentally impossible to return to the deal and prevent a possible Biden administration from returning to the deal.
President Trump has been using his first term's last days to impose a new sanction a week on Iran. That is just to make it all that much harder for a possible Biden administration to return to normalcy with this country. But be ready for an unexpected spin to the true story. Mr. Izadi here is professor of international studies.
I think Mr. Netanyahu is trying to do a favor for President-elect Biden. You know, they know each other for many years. Netanyahu calls Mr. Biden an old friend and part of his family. And what they are trying to do is to create a setting for when Biden becomes president to have leverage against Iran.
So Israel is aiming to help the U.S. bring a weakened Iran to the negotiating table. But what if they get more than they've asked for? Because attacking a fifth and sixth scientist on Iranian soil could provoke an Iranian attack on Israel, hence inviting U.S. intervention in the region yet again. Iran has promised retaliation. It has retaliated in the past against the U.S. Israel should be a lot easier. It's to be seen how and when Iran might do so, so as not to play into foul hands, however. Mr. Tajik joined us by Skype. To hear his experienced views is worth every moment of struggling with the connection.
With such moves, they try to force Iran to react. The next goal is to make Iran play into this scenario of the Zionist regime in Saudi Arabia and the Hebrew Arab faction. This will not happen. And naturally, the Islamic Republic will not set goals and actions based on the scenarios designed by others, but will act on its own plans to achieve its goals.
It is noteworthy that Iranian Parliament's first legal reaction to the assassination was to change the strategic action for lifting of sanctions single urgency motion to double urgency motion with an absolute majority of votes on November the 29th, 2020, in order to speed up action. The motion had been presented earlier and was passed on Tuesday, December the 1st, with 248 yeas. The motion has 9 provisions. Some important provisions are that the Nuclear Energy Organization must produce and store 120 kilograms of 20% enriched uranium annually, must produce 500 kilograms of uranium at different levels of enrichment for peaceful purposes once a month, and must reverse the Arak reactor back to its pre-JCPOA condition. Also, the government is obligated to report in 3 months from the passing of this motion on the compliance of other parties to the JCPOA. Should results not be satisfactory, the government must halt practice of the additional protocol of the NPT. Ms. Fallahi of the Parliamentary National Security Committee explains further.
Regarding this double agency motion, I should say that we didn't propose it in Parliament under the spur of the moment. We had prepared it some 3 months ago, way before the assassination, as a reaction to the non-compliance of the 4+1 countries. It was approved as a single agency motion, then after this unfortunate occurrence, we approved it as a double agency motion to expand our nuclear scientific capabilities. It is completely peaceful and in full compliance with the JCPOA's Articles 36 and 37, which state, should other parties to the deal not fulfill their commitments, we can also reduce our commitments as long as they have not returned to compliance. It is based on what those countries signed themselves.
The website Israel Hayom published a bold headline 29th November that read, "Iran's Tafia makes the world a safer place." It refers to the assassinations of Qasem Soleimani and Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, both recognized as martyrs in Iran. Such headlines coming from Israel sound like confessions, especially because Benjamin Netanyahu in April 2018 did say, "Remember this name," referring to Fakhrizadeh as if putting a target on the scientist's back. For a glimpse into the more credible accounts of how the crime actually happened, we've got Mr. Abedin here with us in the studio. Mohan Abedin is a political analyst for Press TV. Welcome to the studio. Thanks for joining the program. Do feel free to begin your account whenever.
On the morning of Friday, 30th of November, one of Iran's leading scientists and a pioneer in nuclear-related research was transiting through the mountain retreat of Absad, situated nearly 100 kilometers east of the capital city, Tehran. While there are several versions as to what precisely unfolded on the main boulevard of Absad on that fateful morning, the following account is the most credible. As Dr. Fakhrizadeh's car was driving down the boulevard, his car came under attack from gunmen mounted on two motorcycles moving in the opposite direction of the leading scientist's car. As the gunmen on motorcycles approached Dr. Fakhrizadeh's car, they opened fire. Meanwhile, a semi-truck parked on the side of the road on Fakhrizadeh's side and packed with wood suddenly exploded. But the explosion was not as strong or effective as the assassins hoped. However, the explosion forced Dr. Fakhrizadeh out of his car, where he was struck by at least 3 bullets. One of Fakhrizadeh's bodyguards, possibly traveling on a trailing vehicle, tried to shield the leading scientist, and he too was hit by bullets and gravely wounded. Following a short outburst of gunfire, the terrorist quickly fled the scene by traveling down the boulevard and exiting Absad. Contrary to reports, the terrorist had not turned off the small town's electricity supply prior to the attack. The explosion of the semi-truck knocked off the town's power for a brief period. Again, contrary to reports, there were no CCTVs in the vicinity of the attack. for the terrorists to deactivate. The closest CCTV is in a square where the town's municipality is situated. And that's several kilometers away from the scene of the attack.
IRGC Chief General Salomi implies the assassination happened days before the U.S. is driven out of the region, a year from the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani in early January this year. Here are a few lines of his statement on the Fakhrizadeh case. Our missiles and drones are locked on 20,000 targets. Only Israel knows who and where we might aim for. The second defense or reaction plan is to destroy thousands of carriers of tanks, planes, and equipment. No shot will be aimless and in vain. We warn surrounding countries. Any shot from any point in your countries will be the destruction of the whole area. Israel is a prime suspect, not for no good reason. Israel has the capacity and has done it before. It also has a motive and has the U.S.'s blessing, as I said. I asked people from different walks of life how they felt about a prominent Iranian scientist being assassinated on his own soil.
I have a feeling of sadness, anger, and an obligation for me to avenge the blood of this martyr.
I just feel my condolence for such a loss, and I want to express my compassion to my nation. And our society is eager to retaliate. We just want to some retaliation. In the same time, in the same way, at the same level.
We witnessed the cowardly assassination, and I think that the heart of every Iranian and the heart of every free man in the world was saddened. The Iranian people and the whole world condemned such acts.
The available evidence shows the enemies behind this incident were the Americans and the Israelis. We expect the government to fully identify the perpetrators of this assassination and to avenge this martyr.
It's noteworthy the Obama administration condemned Israel's earlier assassinations precisely because it knew the murders wouldn't set back Iran's nuclear program, really, but would set back any efforts to negotiate a deal to curb the program. And now, to get back into that nuclear deal, if Biden wins the U.S. election and takes office, he will most likely have to strongly communicate that Israel will incur costs if it continues to carry out attacks in Iran. The 2015 Iran nuclear deal was signed between Iran and the P5+1. That's the US, UK, France, Russia, China, plus Germany. The nation isn't totally unified in how it views the world, but anti-US sentiment among Iranians still definitely exists and is nothing new. It's not hatred for hatred. It began with US interference in Iran's internal matters even before the revolution. And in the past year alone, the Trump administration has reportedly run several joint sabotage operations with Israel against Iran's nuclear facilities. Also, to assassinate Iranian General Soleimani outside a Baghdad airport early in January, the U.S. relied partly on Israeli intelligence. And earlier this month, Trump himself reportedly raised the possibility of attacking Iran with his top national security advisors. And shortly after, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Arab adversaries of Iran.
This is how they have failed to overthrow the Islamic Republic for the last 41 years. You know, they thought that having Saddam Hussein attack Iran militarily is going to finish the government here. And what they actually did was to prolong the life of the Islamic Republic by creating so many martyrs. And this is what they don't get. They don't understand that the culture here is a culture of martyrdom, a culture of resistance.
Here's what the people thought about whether the loss of another prominent scientist, perhaps the most prominent of those assassinated, would shatter the foundations of Iran's scientific advancement.
Certainly, the scientists who have been martyred have trained many students to follow in their footsteps. Their blood will definitely help us to continue down this path with more strength.
Removing scientists do not lead to deletion of science, and that is the misperception that they have, and they do know that it just make us to pursue knowledge much more than before.
What the enemies and ill wishers of the Islamic Republic should know is that this movement and the progress that has been made during the last 42 years will not be stopped by such events, and we will continue on our path and progress further.
Mr. Ruivaran comments on how the murder might affect the nation.
In terror,
one of its aims was to destroy the morale of the people. As we have seen in the past, society regrets the assassination of its own scientists, and I think this creates a spirit of frustration in society. The security organizations in Iran must act quickly and identify those involved in this crime and respond to them to compensate for the psychological impact on Iranian society.
Apart from the fact that Iran has perhaps hundreds of scientists and institutional knowledge enough to carry on regardless of any single scientist, Mr. Fakhrizadeh's importance is now more symbolic and less for current knowledge of the detail of Iran's present scientific programs.
I believe that knowledge cannot be assassinated. The nuclear or missile knowledge has been localized by Iranian experts. The killing of five other nuclear experts and scientists who were martyred before the signing of the JCPOA did not stop this. The Iranians have gained domestic knowledge that can no longer be stopped.
If it's even possible to excuse Israel's highly probable crime of state terror with the Trump administration's acquiescence, if not complicity, there are those in Israel and the U.S. who see the current maximum pressure policy of U.S. sanctions and threats of attacks on Iran as the only route to stop Iran from expanding its influence, whatever that may mean. The key point is that they think Iran can be controlled by pressure and threats. The five-year history of the JCPOA is enough to prove that theory miserably wrong. The one thing that got Iran to curb its peaceful nuclear program was civility demonstrated in signing that Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or nuclear deal. In return for doing so, nuclear-related economic UN sanctions were to be lifted off Iran. But
they failed to defeat Iran in the fields of hardware and military capabilities, so they opted to focus on the field of software and chaos to eliminate the manifestations of Iran's power, which are its elites and scientists, by the most violent and brutal means, namely terror and assassination. At the same time, while respect for scholars, scientists, and elites has a fundamental place in human nature, for this oppressive order, scientists are perceived as hindrances because they have the knowledge and the enemy knows that they can strengthen their nations.
If partnerships with Israel and Arab states such as Saudi Arabia are to be strategic to the U.S., I'd really reconsider those partnerships, because U.S. strategic partnerships should make the U.S. more secure, not less, to take a page out of responsible statecraft.
Plenty more to be learned and more to be said on the matter, and for that I'll be back in no time. But first, a look at other media outlets to see what they have to say with Shahzad.
Hi, I'm Shahrzad Manoucheri, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on the assassination of Iranian scientists and futile attempts to undermine Iran's progress. Tasnim News Agency states ex-CIA head warns of lethal retaliation after assassination of Iranian scientist. Former CIA Director John Brennan described the assassination of top Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh as a criminal act, warning that this could risk sparking a wider conflagration in the Middle East. This was a criminal act and highly reckless. It risks lethal retaliation and a new round of regional conflict, Brennan tweeted on Friday. Iranian leaders would be wise to wait for the return of responsible American leadership on the global stage and to resist the urge to respond against perceived culprits, he added. In an article by Ruda, we see Bernie Sanders states, assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists, reckless, provocative, and illegal. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders has described the assassination of a high-ranking Iranian nuclear scientist as reckless, provocative, and illegal, and a deliberate act meant to impair the possible incoming American president's foreign policy agenda. Top Israeli officials have not claimed involvement in the assassination. I have no clue who did it. It's not that my lips are sealed because I'm being responsible. I simply have no clue, Israeli Cabinet Minister Tzachi Hanegbi said. That's all for this segment.
Even after the United States of America tried diplomacy, Israel pressed the Trump administration to end U.S. participation in the JCPOA, and that it did in 2018. This meant U.N. sanctions were now reimposed and reinforced on Iran as U.S. sanctions. Tensions between the two states escalated naturally, and escalation of tensions since have brought the U.S. and Iran to the brink of war twice. Strategic partnership to serve one party. In case you're wondering why the U.S. would serve Israel to the disadvantage of its own people, it wouldn't. It's doubtful it would. But Israel has hold over U.S. presidents thanks to AIPAC, the powerful Jewish lobby in America, and now it has an Arab alliance to support it at this end.
The U.S. government and Israel have a strategic alliance with each other. Sometimes America's behavior goes in the direction that it is willing to suffer a lot of losses in order to save the Zionists. The Zionists, on the other hand, are assisting the Americans in the region. In the U.S. strategy, its hegemonic stability is defined by ensuring Israel's security.
I said some in the U.S., Israel, and its apparently newly allied Arabs accuse Iran of expanding its influence in the region. Iran is a millennia-old regional heavyweight and sees itself responsible for maintaining a balance of power in its own region. Do note, the U.S. is over 10,000 kilometers far from this region, and, well, how Israel came about and maintains its presence in the region. Israel is the decades-long entity that rests on occupied Palestine. Also, it's the only entity in West Asia known to have nuclear warheads, hundreds of them. As for its policy of governmental terrorism, let's take a look at some faces from the past.
2010 saw Massoud Ali Mohammadi, a Tehran University professor, assassinated in a pinpoint blast. Also in late 2010, Majid Shahriari, who specialized in neutron transport, met the same fate. Assassins riding motorcycles planted and detonated a C4 bomb on his car door whilst he was driving. He was instantly killed. Fereydoun Abbasi, his fellow nuclear scientist and professor at Shahid Beheshti University, also had a bomb attached to his car and detonated by the killers from a distance. But he and his wife escaped death. They were wounded. In 2011, Dariush Rezai Nejad was gunned down outside his Tehran apartment. He was an electrical engineer, doctoral student, whose work involved nuclear applications. No time wasted. In 2012 came Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan's turn. Motorbike riders attached a magnetic bomb that tore apart a car carrying him. He was a nuclear scientist working at Iran's main uranium enrichment facility in Natanz. Roshan was in fact set to attend a memorial for Massoud Ali Mohammadi, who was killed in similar fashion. After this latest assassination, it's more likely that should Iran return to the negotiating table, it will return stronger with more demands, not weaker.
Thanks for joining us from the whole team. We'll also be doing a piece on the anniversary of the Soleimani assassination. Bye for now.
Did you really read all those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them.
and I'm willing to be directed as well.
How
much are you familiar with the box in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio with Brother Hussein, a book lover and a student of Tarbiyat Mudarris University of Tehran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, avid readers of books, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You've tuned into IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The show is Bookshelf, and I'm Hussein. I'm here if you're looking for a book to read this week. As we travel through life, what's more important than acquiring knowledge in order to live our few years on this earth more appropriately? It's not possible for all of us to excel in science. It needs the proper background and the proper conditions to develop our understanding. But God has blessed us with accessible knowledge, and He has given us individuals among us who surpass the rest of us in knowledge. We may study the findings of these individuals, these great scholars, read their books, and listen to their lectures. And one such figure is Muhammad Taqi Jafari. Muhammad Taqi Jafari was born in a family that was by no means rich, which obviously creates many impediments in his progress in education and academic endeavors. Yet he persisted, and it was his tireless persistence and stamina that turned him into one rich man in knowledge and mysticism. Although he never studied at any university, yet his endeavors led to the creation of invaluable amounts of knowledge, particularly in fields such as philosophy, anthropology, and ideology. Jafari began his formal education at theological schools and seminaries, but his academic career mostly involves comprehensive viewpoints with the context of solving major ideological and philosophical dilemmas. He's been described as a man who avoided prejudiced or limited thoughts and never confined himself to geographical boundaries. His main concern was mankind and the future, a future we cannot afford to neglect. Today we want to introduce a book that has collected parts of Ayatollah Jafari's various books. Stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Bookshelf, and just before the break, we were talking about how there are individuals among us who excel in science and knowledge, and by referring to their books, we can acquire and obtain their knowledge as well. So the book that I want to introduce today is called The Mystery of Life, which is a collection of excerpts from the myriad number of books that Allama Muhammad Taqi Jafari published before his death in 1998. The book deals with a range of subjects related to human life, such as philosophy, mysticism, anthropology, culture, art, history, and much more. You can download the book from al-islam.org. It comes in 323 pages, and after the break, we will be reading page 94 of this book, which is about the necessity of recognizing the ultimate aim of life.
Seven, there are much pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
Stay tuned to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Bookshelf, and we're about to read page 94 of the book, The Mystery of Life. And this page talks about the necessity of recognizing the ultimate aim of life. We can present several reasons why it is necessary to recognize the ultimate aim of life. Many schools of thought throughout history have attempted to seek and present the aim of life. They regard goals merely higher than the petty goals of life as the ultimate end of life. If the relative goals in natural life really could provide the ultimate goal of life, there would be no more need for research on the philosophy of life. As man's knowledge and dominance over his life increases, it has been proven that man's true life is meaningless without choosing higher aims for life. Without an intelligible aim, human life will lose all its value and significance. If the universe and the phenomenon called life have no aim, life will have no meaning at all. As Nasser Khosrow, the renowned Iranian poet, says, "All this world and stars are not all of what there is. Someday, all this will come to an end." There are many different schools of thought on what the aim of life is. Let's study some of them further. Personal goals. Some people consider what they desire, like money, power, science, and maybe even serving people, as their main aim in life. Power. Some intellectuals, like Nietzsche, believe power to be the main aim of life. Making the best choice. Some people, like Nero, Genghis Khan, Alexander, and the pharaohs, are regarded as the best choice in natural life schools of thought. Hedonism. Hedonists believe that saturating one's need for pleasure is the main aim of life. They have mistaken the interpretation of the mechanism of purely natural life for the main aim of life. Comfort and luxury. Some schools of thought see the main aim of life in having luxury and comfort. Can anyone accept the logic that you should lose your life today so that a living human being in the future may have a comfortable life? Now that life today is not any less comfortable than the future, why should it be sacrificed? Furthermore, those human beings whom history remembers as distinguished and aware do not even consider their own comfort as their aim of life. How can they consider the comfort of beings like themselves in the future as their aim of life? Man. Some schools of thought believe that man is the aim of life. Moral ethics, avoiding disturbing others, activating human emotions and respect towards others are the main principles of this belief. The problem with it, however, is that it provides no logical grounds for man to give up his greed and learn how to sacrifice his own wishes for the sake of others. Abstracting the soul from material interests. Some Indian religions consider the aim of life as purifying the soul from all desires, whims, and wishes. Although this belief reinforces one aspect of the soul, it ignores the others, which are activated by establishing a correct relationship between man and the universe. The climax of this aim of life is when the abstraction seeker considers himself as God, claiming that there is nothing in him but God. After quite a convincing study and thoughts that satisfy my conscience, I have come to the conclusion that these Indians, having reached an extremely delicate view of the universe, where they are able to see the universe as a unit for their own perception, make a very strange mistake. Instead of realizing how great their soul is, they make God seem smaller. We can say, however, that if the human soul makes such mistakes in these delicate states, their soul truly has made no progress at all.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
That's all the time that I have, but if I've done my job right, I must have been able to convince you that this book is really worth the read. The book that I introduced is called The Mystery of Life by Allama Muhammad Taghi Jafari, which you can download for free from al-islam.org. You can also download an archive of this episode and our previous episodes from our website. Simply search IRIB English Radio Bookshelf. Until next week. And a lot of studying. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. الذين يستمعون
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.